Hello, welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Sarah, and I too would like to welcome everyone to the Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, Progress in the Treatment of Multiple Myeloma, and this is part one of Living with Multiple Myeloma. And today's program is supported by an educational grant from Janssen Biotech, Inc., administered by Janssen Scientific Affairs, LLC, and I really want to thank them for their support of today's program. Now, we have a lot of people on the call today. There are over 200 participants on this program today, and you come from all of the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Canada, Egypt, India, Iran, Kuwait, Pakistan, the Philippines, Romania, Switzerland, and the United Kingdom. So this is truly a global call, and it's a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Barry Paul. And Dr. Paul is with the Division of Plasma Cell Disorders, Department of Hematologic Oncology and Blood Disorders, Levine Cancer Institute II, Carolina's healthcare system. And Dr. Paul will be addressing an overview of the progress in the treatment of multiple myeloma, current standard of care, including clinical trial updates, and new and emerging treatments. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Paul.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. It's the afternoon here. I'm in Charlotte, North Carolina. So wherever you all are, hope you're having similar weather to what we're having here today. It's beautiful outside. So let's start. So I want to start with one of the most important things that has happened in the last 12 months, and that is the acceptance of minimal residual disease, or MRD testing, as a validated surrogate biomarker for clinical trials. And what that means is that if a patient achieves MRD negativity, so that is a very low burden of disease in the bone marrow, specifically it's less than one cell in 100,000 bone marrow cells, that is a predictor of a long-term response. So why this is important is because now we can do clinical trials and we can get our answers much more rapidly. We don't have to wait for years because myeloma patients tend to do really well. So clinical trials oftentimes take a long time to read out. So now we have this MRD endpoint where we can check to see how deep a response they're in, and that's a good enough surrogate that we can get drugs approved with that endpoint, and that helps us to get drugs to patients much more quickly. It gets drugs approved much more quickly, clinical trials read out much more quickly, and then I can give great updates like I'm going to give you all today. So that's a really important update that happened in April of last year, and that was a real win for patients, so that's great news. So let me start with smoldering myeloma. I think many of you are familiar with this. This is a precursor condition that we think, we can't capture it in all patients, but we think it predates all myeloma patients, that patients will have a degree of smoldering myeloma, which is asymptomatic myeloma, and it's only confined to the bone marrow. And we hope that if we capture patients who have smoldering myeloma, we can treat it before it gets to the point where it can be problematic and patients can have the types of symptoms that we're all familiar with. The challenge has been, traditionally, we've only done surveillance in these patients because not all patients with smoldering myeloma will progress to active myeloma, so there's various types of staging systems that predict which patients are going to be the most likely to progress to myeloma. And for these high-risk patients, there is now a recent trial got a commercial approval for a drug called daratumumab, which is a well-known treatment for myeloma, but for patients with high-risk smoldering myeloma that were given this drug for 3 years, their risk of progression to active myeloma diminished significantly. And these are the high-risk patients that have the highest risk of progressing to active myeloma. So we were able to prevent these patients from ever having active myeloma. Now, this data is only about 5 years of follow-up, so we'll have to see if that continues to be the case. But it's very interesting that even after 3 years of treatment, the response tends to be durable. So those patients that are off the daratumumab after 3 years still have a lower likelihood of progressing to active myeloma. The other critique of this trial that's important is that they used an older definition of high-risk smoldering myeloma. So the current definition, the most widely accepted definition, only about 40% of the patients on this trial actually had that. So it's a little less representative of what we would consider to be high-risk in today's day and age, but still a really important trial and, you know, likely to change some management in some patients. So that's important. So let's move on to newly diagnosed multiple myeloma. There hasn't been as many changes in what's called the transplant-eligible population, the patients who go through induction treatment and get a standard of care and then a stem cell transplant. But what we're now looking at is using perhaps CAR T-cell therapy instead of stem cell transplant. So there's a trial that's currently enrolling that randomizes patients to upfront chemotherapy, the standard DARA-RVD regimen, and then randomizes patients to either getting a cilta-cel CAR T or stem cell transplant as their consolidation. And that's a very important trial that will help us to determine if CAR T is better for consolidation than transplant. Well, it's going to take a long time for this to read out as well, but a very important trial for sure. In the transplant ineligible population, I think the biggest change has been the advent of more quadruplet therapy in that population. Traditionally, we were using triplet therapy, daratumumab, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone for that population. But there were several studies that came out in the last 12 months that indicate that giving quadruplet therapy, so a CD38 antibody plus bortezomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone, seems to be well tolerated and improve efficacy. Now, importantly, the transplant ineligible definition is not clear, and in many trials, they actually enroll patients who are what you call transplant deferred, meaning that they are eligible for transplant, but they've elected to not get transplanted at this time. They may get it later, but they're not interested in getting transplanted at this time. Similarly, different areas, geographic areas, different centers have different protocols for what does and does not constitute transplant eligibility. So a lot of these trials are not as generalizable because a lot of the patients who are on the trials would be considered transplant eligible in some places and maybe not in others. A lot of these trials don't enroll frail patients, which obviously is a more transplant ineligible population, but certainly has other medical problems that potentially make quadruplet therapy a little more challenging because the more drugs you add, the more toxicities you can potentially see. But certainly in certain patients, you know, doing a little bit more aggressive treatment is not without benefit and can be done safely. Similarly, there was a trial that was recently published called the REST trial. This also was for transplant-ineligible patients. And what they did in this trial is they actually stopped dexamethasone after two cycles. So a lot of patients really struggle to tolerate dexamethasone. The high-dose steroid that you get, it causes people to feel restless. It can raise your blood sugar. It can cause weight gain. It can make you make it challenging to sleep. So stopping dexamethasone after two cycles was, you know, really, patients really appreciated that, and they did very, very well. So it didn't seem to have any, you know, decrement on the efficacy of the treatment. So certainly that's also something that bears looking into and perhaps asking your doctor about, do I need to stay on dexamethasone? So let's move on to maintenance therapy because it was a very important trial that came out for maintenance therapy. So this is patients who went through transplant and now are getting maintenance therapy to keep their disease under control. And this trial is called the ARIGA trial. And this trial is important. The enrollment criteria for people who did not get a CD38 antibody with their induction. So they probably got triplet therapy with bortezomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone, something like that. And then they had a suboptimal response to transplant. So that means they went through induction, they got their transplant, but they still had a good response, but not a great response. They were either in a VGPR or a complete response, but they were MRD positive. We spoke about MRD earlier, so these were patients that were still MRD positive. And in these patients, They were randomized to either get lenalidomide maintenance, which is the standard of care, or lenalidomide plus daratumumab maintenance, and there was a significant benefit in these patients with the addition of daratumumab. So again, if for these patients who didn't get a CD38 antibody up front and who didn't have as great a response as we hope to get with their transplant, there's a great reason to give them two drugs, daratumumab and lenalidomide, for maintenance. There's a trial that just finished enrolling a couple months ago called the DRAMATIC trial, and that trial was similar in fact that it enrolled patients, it randomized patients to either Daralen or Len alone, but that trial enrolled people who had had a CD38 antibody with their induction, and it allowed people who were in MRD negative complete responses. So that's going to be a really important trial and probably a little more generalizable for those of us that are using quadruplet therapy in our earlier lines of therapy, because most of our patients are CD38 exposed prior to transplant. So keep an eye out for that. And then lastly, moving on to the relapse refractory population, those who have been through induction therapy, consolidation, what have you, or their frontline therapy, and unfortunately their myeloma has come back. Great news, we have lots of good options for these patients. And a couple of new ones I just want to highlight. There was a drug that was approved several years ago called belantamab mafodotin. It's what's called a BCMA antibody drug conjugate, meaning it targets BCMA, but it targets it in a different way than the CAR-Ts or the bispecific antibodies. And that drug was initially approved, but then got pulled from the market because the phase 3 trial wasn't quite as impressive when it was used as a single agent. Well, now we're using it in combination, and there was two trials, treated with belantamab, pomalidomide, dexamethasone, another one with belantamab, bortezomib, dexamethasone, and both of these trials were very successful. So patients did very well on these trials. Belantamab has a unique toxicity. It causes blurry vision and dry eyes, but the dosing that they were able to use when used in combination was far less problematic, and patients were able to get the majority of their doses, and not many patients had to have their doses stopped or anything like that. So keep an eye out for belantamab in the future. I'll also talk about anito-cel, which is a newer BCMA CAR-T. Many of you have probably heard of Cilta-cel or Ide-cel, the two commercially available CAR-Ts. Anito-cel, which was just presented at the ASH meeting in December, the data looks very good. It looks like it's very effective and maybe has a little bit lower toxicity than some of the other CAR-Ts, so keep an eye out for that. That's a very exciting drug as well. And lastly, I'll talk about Arlo-cel, which is a GPRC5D CAR-T. So there's already a GPRC targeting bispecific called talquetamab that's commercially available in many places, but there's not a CAR-T that targets GPRC. Talquetamab is a very effective drug, but it does have some unique toxicities. It causes people to lose their sense of taste. It can cause some skin and nail issues. The GPRC5D CAR-T, Arlo-cel, seems to be pretty effective, and it doesn't seem to have that degree of toxicity that patients are able to tolerate it much better. So hopefully that's going to be an important treatment for people down the road. There's phase 3 trials that are currently enrolling right now, and hopefully this will be approved in the next 1 to 2 years. So with that, that's a whirlwind tour through where we're at with myeloma right now, but I'll transfer back to Dr. Messner for our next speaker. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Paul. That was a stellar presentation. And as the first presenter, you certainly offered a great deal of information and hope to our participants. So thank you so much. That was an excellent presentation. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Dr. Andrew Yi. And Dr. Yi is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School, Clinical Director, Center for Myeloma, Multiple Myeloma, Massachusetts General Hospital Cancer Center. And Dr. Yi will be addressing the role of transplantation, preventing and managing treatment side effects, symptoms, discomfort, and pain, and reducing complications of bone disease. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Yi.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and I'd like to thank Cancer Care and the industry sponsors for helping to make this important discussion of progress in multiple myeloma happen. And I'd like to thank Dr. Paul for the fantastic overview of some of the new and exciting developments in multiple myeloma. So, the first topic to discuss is the role of transplantation. And this is, I'll just preface this by saying this is one of the more complicated topics of multiple myeloma, where there are multiple viewpoints on transplantation, multiple myeloma. I know Dr. Paul alluded to that. So when we think of multiple myeloma therapy, we can think of it in different stages. One is, you know, to get the disease under control, the induction therapy, and that can take the role of a four-drug regimen, which is increasingly being used for both younger and older patients. And then we think about transplant. So transplant is also known as a bone marrow transplant. It's also known as an auto stem cell transplant. And initially, when people think of the word transplant, they think about there's some kind of operating room involved where there's a surgeon or something along that. That could be a person's initial reaction to that. But with the transplant, it's actually the stem cells that are being transplanted, and it's given as if you're getting an infusion. But I should just preface things by saying that in the transplant, what's doing the heavy lifting, like the special sauce, so to speak, of the transplant is really high-dose chemotherapy. So it's essentially giving patients high-dose, old-fashioned chemotherapy, and with this drug, melphalan. And this is a therapy that's been around for several decades, right? So back in, you know, the 80s or 90s, they didn't have drugs like the ones that Dr. Paul was talking about. There are two memories, cetuximab or lenalidomide or bortezomib. So back several decades ago, for patients to get a response, they had to use high-dose chemotherapy, so high-dose melphalan. And where the transplant comes into play is that your stem cells, which are kind of like the queen bee of your bone marrow, right? So if you think about a queen bee, you can take a queen bee and you can put the queen bee into an empty bone marrow, into an empty beehive, and she'll recreate the whole beehive, right? So the stem cells are kind of like the queen bee, which can recreate the whole bone marrow. And there's been innovations over the years where there's a way to get these stem cells to come out of the bone marrow with medications, and then they're collected as if you're donating blood. So patients, when they get prepared for the stem cell transplant, they get treatments to get these stem cells to come out of the bone marrow, and then they're collected as if they're donating blood. And then they're put away in the freezer for safekeeping. And then patients will then get high-dose chemotherapy, so that's high-dose melphalan. And then the stem cells, which are previously collected, they are given back to the patient just like a blood transfusion. So the stem cells are there to help. They're like a form of supportive care where they're there to help accelerate your bone marrow's ability to recover. So it shortens the period of time when the blood counts are low is when you use your stem cells to kind of recharge the bone marrow a lot faster. Now, with a high-dose chemotherapy, this is old-fashioned chemotherapy, so I think about old-fashioned side effects of this chemotherapy. So, you know, when patients are getting the four-drug regimen, like the Dara, the Len, the bortezomib, dexamethasone, we don't normally hear about, like, GI side effects, for example, or hair loss. But with the bone marrow transplant, when you have the high-dose melphalan, the old-fashioned high-dose chemotherapy, you do have those old-fashioned side effects. So hair loss, nausea, diarrhea are very common. And in many institutions, patients are hospitalized for the supportive care to monitor and to help patients manage some of those side effects. Though there are some institutions which do everything as an outpatient. And then there's about a month or two-month recovery period to recover from the effects of the high-dose chemotherapy. So in current practice, current myeloma therapy can be a combination of doing the four-drug regimen, and then they can incorporate the transplant. And then what's the motivation for incorporating the transplant? As you heard from Dr. Paul discuss earlier, it's this idea of MRD, or trying to get your disease as deep a response as possible, because generally speaking, the deeper the response, the longer the better the outcomes. Now, when you do the high-dose chemotherapy, it doesn't cure patients, but you definitely do get a deeper response. So when you get a deeper response, that generally translates into longer periods of time when you can continue on the treatment without having to change gears. So you have a longer progression-free survival. Now, where it gets complicated is how critical is it the path you take to getting to that best disease response. And there can be a lot of variation in opinion from institution to institution. But I think that there's general agreement that if you do the high-dose chemotherapy, that's the fastest way to get to the deepest response in conjunction with the four-drug regimen. Now, there can be, you know, I think increasingly, though, there are people who are exploring, you know, whether or not you need to have that high-dose chemotherapy. Because I think, you know, when we take care of patients, the patients generally, they're really anxious and apprehensive about starting therapy. But once they start therapy, they realize, hey, this isn't really that bad. And they actually are feeling better. And then we have this discussion about the transplant. And then patients say, do I really have to do all that? Now, you're telling me my disease is in great response. Do I have to go through all that high-dose chemotherapy? And again, that's a really nuanced discussion between you and your treatment team. I think that, again, there's general agreement that you can get the best, deepest response with that as quickly as possible when you incorporate that. And then there are patients where there are features of the disease where your treatment team may feel that it's important to incorporate that upfront as part of your therapy. Okay, so then I was going to turn quickly to some of the side effects of treatment, and I just wanted to touch upon some side effects that patients, you know, that you don't always hear, because generally speaking, when we talk about side effects of treatment, we talk about low blood counts and fatigue and risk of infection, but I wanted to highlight some side effects to be aware of. And one is with bortezomib and Velcade. We do know that peripheral neuropathy, such as numbness and tingling, can be a common side effect, and how we think about managing that can be either dose reduction or spacing out the dosing. So spacing out the dosing can be helpful for managing numbs and tingling of the feet. And it's important to let your team know about that because it can kind of creep up on you. And I think the earlier you recognize it, we're more apt to kind of either pause the dose, reduce the dose, or think about some supportive therapies to help patients manage that side effect. Another side effect to be aware of is that sometimes with this drug Velcade, it can cause styes on the eyelids. That's something you don't really hear about that much, but it's something to be aware of where patients can develop styes, and we call it also known as blepharitis. And again, that can be managed with topical treatments for the eyes or, again, holding the Velcade treatment. The other side effect to appreciate is that the dexamethasone, that is an important part of the treatment, and Dr. Paul alluded to a clinical trial where we're increasingly looking at potentially decreasing dose or even holding it all together. I think the dexamethasone is important to get the ball rolling, but, you know, for patients who have, you know, trouble sleeping or sometimes they can be really tired in the days in between therapy, we're really keen to think about, okay, how can we make the treatment work better? And one approach is to decrease the dose of the dexamethasone. So I think that's something we're more keen to do. But I think patients, it's important, you know, when you have an appointment with their team, there's so many topics to cover, and I think it's important to bring that up. Third side effect I wanted to bring up would be, you know, diarrhea that can happen with the lenalidomide medication. I think in the beginning, patients don't necessarily have diarrhea. That's not something that's a common side of something in the beginning, but as patients are on this drug long-term as part of maintenance, that is a side effect that can emerge. And I think there are ways of managing that. Some patients can manage that with, you know, using Imodium or over-the-counter Imodium, but then there are other medications to help manage that, such as, you know, colistipol or cholestyramine or Welchol. These are all therapies that can be important. But I think ultimately our goal here is to help patients have as smooth as experience as possible with the treatment, because it's a long journey. And then finally, I just want to talk about bone-related complications, because as for some of the patients on this phone call, in bone disease is how the myeloma was discovered. They had a compression fracture, or they had a pain in their arm or their leg. And for these patients, the bone symptoms are front and center. There are a couple of ways of thinking about the bone-related complications. One is for compression fractures, we can think about kyphoplasty, which is putting medical cement into the bone that was affected by the myeloma led to a compression fracture. And you know, for the majority of patients, that can really significantly improve the symptoms at that site. Second part of supportive care for bone-related complications would be to use a bone strengthener such as zoledronic acid, also known as Zometa, or denosumab, also known as Xgeva. And these medications help strengthen the bone and help prevent bone-related problems down the road. But something to be aware of with these medications is that can lower calcium significantly, so it's important for patients to be on calcium and vitamin D supplementation. And also to be aware of is that there's a rare complication called osteonecrosis of the jaw, where it affects how well healing can occur in the jaw, and that can be provoked by invasive dental procedures like a tooth extraction or a dental implant. But fillings, routine cleanings are not an issue. So I think there's so much to cover here. I don't want to take away from the other speakers. So I hopefully helped shed some light on some of these topics. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak.
Dr. Messner, we're ready for our next speaker.
And our next speaker is Dr. Elizabeth O'Donnell. And Dr. O'Donnell is a clinical director of Early Detection and Prevention Center, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, assistant professor of medicine, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. O'Donnell will be addressing talking with your treatment team about quality of life concerns, the increasing role of telehealth and telemedicine appointments, lifestyle, physical activity, and balance concerns with practical tips.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to join you today to talk about a number of important topics within multiple myeloma, including quality of life concerns, the role of lifestyle and physical activity, and also really how to optimize discussions with your providers about healthcare, particularly as we think about the ways in which we now can conduct medicine. So to begin with, one of the most kind of under-talked about sometimes topics within myeloma is quality of life. And, you know, we do have data that suggests that the quality of life of patients with multiple myeloma and their caregivers can be significantly impacted. And there are considerable rates of depression, anxiety, and post-traumatic stress disorders. And so how do we bring those discussions into our visits with our providers? In addition to that, some of the medications can exacerbate some of the emotional feelings that we have or quality of life concerns, particularly with regard to sleep. And so what I always encourage patients to do is to really communicate with their entire healthcare team about, especially about things like sleep, where we can change doses of medications, particularly that dexamethasone, if it's interrupting sleep or changing moods. And we welcome those conversations. And so letting your team know, your doctor, your nurse practitioner, your nurse, your infusion nurse, we're all working together to try to ensure the best possible care. And so if there are factors that are going on that are treatment-related, that are impacting your quality of life, some other things too, like numbness or tingling in your fingers or toes, called peripheral neuropathy, if you're having symptoms that are changing the way you live, it's really important to discuss those with your doctor so that we can make mild modifications that will help those symptoms. It won't, you know, change dramatically your treatment course, but we can do things. And the way that we're able to really fine-tune your treatment is through those open lines of discussion. So the real take-home message here today is to feel free to communicate with your team. We want to hear it. And then, you know, moving on to talk a little bit about elements of quality of life, such as physical activity, how you feel, how you're able to live and conduct your activities of daily living. You know, it's very common when people are first diagnosed with a cancer that there's a lot of help being given. And what I always encourage my patients to do is to try to continue to keep doing those activities of daily living that you have always done. And so physical activity can take on a number of forms. It does not necessarily mean running a marathon. It can mean doing the dishes, doing the laundry, folding laundry, keeping active. Yes, exercise is a form of physical activity, but You know, there are lots of gentle exercises, walking, yoga, riding a stationary bike that's not weight-bearing. I often say even just putting on some music and moving around your home, dancing, is not only is it good physical activity, it's good for your soul. So really trying to stay active and also avoiding being sedentary. You know, so we spend a lot of our time in life locked to our computers or our desks, but if you're taking a phone call, you know, we don't have landlines anymore. We all use mobile phones. That's an opportunity to stand up and to move around so that you can limit that sedentary time. And, you know, these are all good habits that promote your wellness. I do think it's important in the myeloma population, if you are thinking about exercise, it is important to talk to your oncologist and your team first just to make sure with your active disease if that what exercises are or might not be advisable. And finally, the last thing I want to talk about is really how to get the most out of your appointments. And so when you think about the schedule, you know, for a lot of myeloma therapies are coming in on a pretty regular basis. Even so, sometimes things happen in the interim between those visits. And so I encourage people to write things down. And sometimes you can use your phone to make those notes so you don't, you know, no one typically forgets to bring their phone. So you have that note taking in your phone. Also, if you have someone come with you, a family member, a caregiver, a friend, you know, make sure that one of their jobs in being there is to remind you to bring up any questions you have. So come prepared. So that you don't walk out of that appointment and say, gosh, I wish I'd asked that. And really going back to what I said before, underscoring the importance of really seeing this as an open dialogue, an open communication, where your team does really want to know those little details of things that are happening so that they can fine-tune your therapy. Treatment for myeloma goes on for long periods of time, and so it's important that we treat it like a marathon, not a sprint, and adjust our pace accordingly so that you're going to do well over the long duration of therapy. Again, I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak in this conference, and I'm going to turn it back over to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. O'Donnell. That was just a wonderful presentation, quite stellar, and actually really highlighting the importance of your quality of life and just the importance of your lifestyle and physical activity and balance concerns. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Ms. Diana Bearden. And Ms. Bearden is an oncology dietitian with the Michael E. DeBakey VA Medical Center. And Ms. Bearden will be addressing the role of the oncology dietitian and nutrition and hydration concerns and tips. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Bearden.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. I'm excited to be part of today's presentation. Nutrition and hydration are fundamental in your tolerance to your treatment and giving you the energy to do the things that you enjoy. During your treatment journey, we've heard today about potential side effects that can come along. Not every person will experience every single side effect, and not to the extent of how everybody's experiencing it. Your experience is unique. And so it's so important that you talk with your healthcare team about what you're going through and the changes that you're seeing in your body. Some of the side effects we've heard today, nausea, diarrhea, constipation, fatigue, potentially a decreased appetite, are things that may impact your eating. And so you have a dietitian on staff on your team who can provide you individual information, individualized nutrition planning to focus on your nutrition needs specifically based on what you're going through and taking in consideration any other comorbidities you might be dealing with simultaneously. Things can change throughout your treatment journey. And so you know, there'll be a lot of different changes based on what you're going through and the treatment that you're receiving at the time. In general, a plant-based diet is most ideal, and it's ideal for prevention, during treatment, and in survivorship. A plant-based diet is where you have about two-thirds of your plate from a plant-based food, such as a whole grain, fruit, vegetable, nut, and seed. Plant-based foods provide important components such as antioxidants, fiber, polyphenol, phytochemicals, which help your body function optimally. It's important for you to have these components in your diet. Fresh and frozen are the best forms of our plant-based food. The goal is to incorporate a variety of colors. Frozen is really great, I tell people all the time, because as we go through changes through treatment, you can put it back in the freezer if it's something that isn't working for you right then and you aren't wasting a lot of additional funds on groceries. Gives you a little bit more flexibility. The other third of your plate should come from a lean protein source, such as a wild-caught fish, such as cold water fish like tuna, salmon, halibut, sardines. It doesn't matter if these particular products are canned. With our protein sources, the canning doesn't result in the same outcomes as it does with our fruits and vegetables. Other lean proteins are things like poultry and lean cuts of red meat, and sometimes just bringing in some of our plant-based proteins such as beans, peas, or lentils. Protein is the building block for our tissue and our cellular development. So we need to make sure that, you know, that you're getting the nutrition that you need during your treatment so that you can recover and heal and have the energy to do the things that you enjoy. Hydration is something that's left off sometimes because we're very focused on weight and managing side effects and things like that. But dehydration can actually amplify some of the side effects that we've discussed, and including making you feel dizzy and lightheaded and even giving you headaches. But fluid is anything that's liquid at room temperature, such as water, milk, juice. Those are some great options. And a general guideline is most people need between 8 and 10 8-ounce glasses of fluid a day. So if you're experiencing any side effects, please reach out to your team as quickly as possible so they can help you as quickly as possible. And don't forget your dietitian's part of your healthcare team and know how to reach all the members so you can get in contact with them as quickly as possible. I'm going to hand the line back over to Carolyn. Thanks so much for having me be part of today's workshop.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Bearden. That was just a wonderful, stellar presentation. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you so much. And I'm just going to say a few words about our cancer care services, and then we're going to ask all of you just a few questions, and then we'll take the question, we'll do a question and answer period. So cancer care is a national nonprofit organization, and we provide a host of free programs and services nationally throughout the United States. Many people call our Hope Line, a national Hope Line number, 800-813-4673, and that line is answered by oncology social workers. And people often call around issues around transportation to treatment, practical and financial assistance, co-payment assistance. Also, many people want to join an online support group, and we have online support groups for all different types of cancer, including multiple myeloma. We also have online support groups for caregivers and for young adults, older adults, partners, LGBT community. So we really have a host of different types of online support groups. And I very much welcome you to visit our website, www.cancercare.org, and you will get a host of all the different services that we do offer. And now we're going to move right on to the Q&A. I'm going to ask Sarah to go ahead and explain to you how to queue up for questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
So we have a number of questions, and so this is a question for Dr. Paul. Do you have any recommendations for dealing with eye irritation during treatment?
So I think it would depend on what the treatment that you're getting is. There's a lot of different potential toxicities associated with certain treatments. Certainly some are relatively mild and can be treated with just a warm compress, so that's always okay to try that. But some require treating with some antibiotics, perhaps some, rewetting drops, or even maybe having to decrease the dose of treatment or change treatment around. So it's certainly a conversation to have with your local physician.
And another question for Dr. Paul, should I consider a second opinion after relapse, what are the indicators that a patient may need to go to see a provider at a specialized cancer center?
Yeah, so great question. I always advocate for patients to see a specialist in myeloma, with every major treatment decision, quite honestly. There are some really effective therapies out there that may not have made their way into some community practices just yet. They're probably on their way there, but not quite yet. So I certainly would always recommend someone being seen by a tertiary care or a myeloma specialist who has a little bit more perhaps experience with some of the newer therapies, maybe has some clinical trial opportunities with some, you know, really exciting emerging therapies. So I absolutely would recommend seeing a specialist if there's one that can be scheduled.
Excellent. Thank you. Another question for Dr. Paul. Would you consider MGUS more common than multiple myeloma?
It was MGUS. Is that what you said? I'm sorry.
MGUS, yes.
Yes. MGUS is more common than multiple myeloma. MGUS is a precursor condition. So there's sort of a stratagem. It goes from MGUS to smoldering myeloma and into active myeloma. We pretty much are sure that all patients go along that evolution. So MGUS is clearly the most popular, most common, but the vast majority of patients with MGUS do not progress to anything more than just MGUS. And it's very common in patients. It gets more common as people age, but in people in their 70s or 80s, it's present in 5 to 10% of the population. So that's a very large number. And as I said, the vast majority of those patients will never have anything more than just a laboratory abnormality. So right now, the recommendations are not to screen for MGUS unless there's other concerning signs or symptoms that may predict a little something more dangerous.
Thank you. And a question for Dr. Paul. What are the common side effects of lenalidomide or pomalidomide?
So the IMIDs have some notable side effects. The most common is low blood counts. So the IMIDs will decrease some of your healthy blood cells. So when that happens, you can get a little bit more susceptible to infection. You can be a little bit more fatigued if you have some anemia. That's a low red blood cell count. So that's the most common. That typically can be mitigated by, you know, changing the dosing around. So your provider should be looking at your counts and perhaps changing your dosing accordingly. Some things that are a little bit less common with lenalidomide, certainly rash. Rash is common, rash is not common, but does happen. This is particularly when someone starts it. You usually get acclimated to it after a couple of cycles, and this goes away. The rash is a truncal rash, so it's present oftentimes on the back and the chest. It can typically, it doesn't usually get itchy, but it can. It's typically easily managed with just some topical steroid cream, hydrocortisone, triamcinolone, those kinds of creams. So that certainly can happen. Diarrhea, and Dr. Yee spoke about this, diarrhea can happen with lenalidomide. That can be managed with some changes in dosing or some other medications, as he addressed earlier. And then sometimes people get some edema, some lower extremity edema. Sometimes they get some edema around their eyes, some puffy eyes or swollen ankles, that kind of thing. Again, not tremendously challenging, just a little bothersome. Pomalidomide is much more associated with lower blood counts, so that's one we really need to be watching the blood counts for sure. Rash, to some extent. But pomalidomide is typically a little easier for patients to tolerate than lenalidomide.
Excellent. Another question for you. What is the relationship between proteasome inhibitors and shingles? Does a patient have to take an antiviral before starting therapy?
Yeah, so great question. So proteasome inhibitors and anti-CD38 antibodies as well do predispose patients to have reactivation of shingles. So shingles is reactivation of the varicella virus. That's the virus that causes chickenpox. So if you had chickenpox as a child, you have the ability to get shingles later in life. And even if you get the shingles vaccine, which I absolutely recommend, with proteasome inhibitors or anti-CD38 antibodies, that suppresses your body's ability to make the antibodies that keep shingles under control. So when those antibodies, those healthy antibodies, are not produced, you have the potential, increased potential for reactivation of shingles. So an antiviral, the typical ones would be valacyclovir or acyclovir, is very, very effective in preventing those reactivation events. and they're really well tolerated. So I rarely have patients who, you know, have any side effects from being on those agents.
And another question for you, Dr. Paul. Are there any updates on CAR T cell therapy and multiple myeloma?
So updates, I mean, there's always updates, I guess. It's just a question of how up-to-date we're trying to be here. The most recent approval was both ide-cel and cilta-cel got approved for earlier lines of therapy. So now cilta-cel is approved for first relapse in patients who are lenalidomide refractory. So this is typically the patient who has gone through induction, transplant, and then lenalidomide maintenance and now has progressed on lenalidomide maintenance, so they're eligible for cilta-cel at that point. Ide-cel is approved now for two or more prior lines. So these are patients who have been through another line of therapy after maybe transplant and upfront maintenance and that kind of thing. But they're approved for earlier lines of therapy. As I mentioned earlier in my talk, they're looking now at CAR-T instead of transplant. You know, there's a clinical trial that I alluded to earlier, where they're doing a randomization where patients are getting induction and then they're randomized to either transplant versus CAR-T, so that's going to be a very important clinical trial. And then, as I mentioned in my earlier talk, there's the new BCMA CAR-T that's anito-cel, and there's the new GPRC5D CAR-T that's arlo-cel. Both of those look very impressive in their early data, so hopefully those will continue to evolve and we'll see more data about that and ideally an FDA approval in the not-too-distant future.
And another question for you, Dr. Paul, how does plasma exchange work for multiple myeloma patients?
So plasma exchange is only done for patients who have really uncontrolled disease or something called hyperviscosity syndrome. So when the level of antibody in your blood gets so high, and this is very, very high, this is really uncontrolled myeloma, it should only happen when someone has been undiagnosed. This should not happen when you're on treatment, but when someone's undiagnosed and they probably, you know, unfortunately haven't had access to care or maybe haven't seek care for a period of time and their myeloma is really uncontrolled, the level of antibody in your blood can get so high that it causes your blood to sludge. It makes the blood thick. And when the blood gets thick, the heart can't push it to places it needs to go, and you can get really severe complications. So that's an indication for emergent plasma exchange. And the idea is you take all the protein out of your blood and you replace it with healthy protein. And the hope is that by taking out lots of protein, you're getting mostly that antibody, so the blood will be less thick and your heart will be able to pump it around to your body. You should not be, you know, getting plasma exchange very frequently. I probably do it maybe twice a year in patients who are in really severe uncontrolled disease when they're maybe presenting, but hopefully that's not happening.
And another question for you, Dr. Paul, why do patients with multiple myeloma often end up developing kidney disease?
Yeah, so the protein that the myeloma makes, the antibody or the light chain, depending on your subtype of myeloma, can either damage the kidney by binding to different parts of the kidney as it's being cleared from your body, because that's how it does get excreted. It gets excreted in the urine. Or sometimes the level is just so high that it damages the kidneys because it sort of clogs them up, just like a hair clog in a sink. So both of those things can be quite damaging to the kidney. So, you know, certainly the best treatment for that is to get the level down low quickly. And certainly if you have that subtype that seems to be a little bit more damaging to the kidneys, to get it as low as possible. So these are certainly important parts of treating myeloma patients.
Excellent. And so the question is, so this would be from Ms. Bearden, how do I get enough protein, Ms. Bearden, if you could address this?
Absolutely. So foods that are great sources of protein are going to be things like our animal protein, such as eggs, cheese, cottage cheese, yogurt. I always suggest the Greek yogurt. And then, of course, meat, chicken, fish, turkey. Always choosing your leaner proteins as possible and bringing in some of those cold water fish like salmon, tuna, halibut, sardines, other fish are fine as well. And then there are some plant-based proteins such as beans, quinoa is a really good complete protein. And other foods that have protein in them, they just aren't a high protein source. They're going to be things like peanut butter and nuts. They're mainly fat. There's a small amount of protein in them. Also, milk is a great protein source. If you choose an almond milk, make sure you get the high protein version. Almond milk and other nut milks are just naturally low in protein, so you need to make sure to read for the high protein version of those. So any of those foods will help increase protein in your diet.
Well, thank you. And just a reminder that we have part two of this program. It's taking place next week on Thursday, April 3rd, coping with the stresses of caregiving when your loved one has multiple myeloma. So some of you have signed up for that already, but if you haven't, it's a great program coming up. And I'm just going to ask our speakers, I'm going to ask Dr. Paul and Ms. Bearden to provide takeaways for our participants from today's program. So I'll start with Dr. Paul.
Yeah, so I think, you know, this came up in the question and answer session, but I absolutely recommend that anyone dealing with myeloma does try to reach out and find a myeloma specialist. And, you know, oftentimes it may require a little bit of a travel, but hopefully not in, you know, in this day and age. Dr. O'Donnell dealt with, mentioned this, that we have telehealth options and things like that. So once you're established, that person can still be checking in on things, following up on your responses, labs, things like that, and making some suggestions. Just because it's just so hard to treat every type of cancer now, and I personally couldn't do it. So I think, you know, seeing a specialist is always a great idea. So I would say that's one take-home message. My other take-home message is that nobody wants to be diagnosed with myeloma, and I 100% understand that. But I will tell you this, that there is a lot of hope, and things are going in leaps and bounds better than they were 10, 20, 30 years ago, and that trend continues. So there's reasons to be excited. There is potential. We are talking about discontinuing therapy in certain patients now, you know, because there is such a deep response. So there is lots to be excited about. So nobody wants to be a myeloma patient, and I understand that. But, you know, if you have to be, this is a good time. So there's reasons to be excited.
Excellent. Thank you. And Ms. Bearden?
You know, I'm just going to encourage everybody to know their healthcare team members and know how to reach out to them. Healthcare team members such as social work, dietitian, the physician, maybe the nurse practitioner, the physician assistant, anybody you're in contact with, get their contact information, know how to reach them. I always encourage patients to make sure you understand your, how to take your medications for side effects, that you, you know, understand how, what to take for what symptom and what issue, and to just be in communication with your team as much as possible. It's always great to bring in notes, and I always love it when somebody comes in and they have, okay, I've been taking some notes. Can I share this with you? I love that, because there's so much that we forget just in our day-to-day lives. We're so busy these days that it can be easy to you know, forget to bring something up in a meeting unless you have it written down.
Excellent. Thank you. I want to thank all of our speakers. You've been phenomenal. I want to thank also our participants for really asking such great questions. And I want to comment about the questions. For those of you who have the opportunity to ask a question, I still recommend that you go back to your treating healthcare team member. You've learned a lot from today's program, so your question, you'll be able to hear the answer more clearly, and you'll be able to ask your question more clearly. Ask your question of your healthcare team because they know you the best. And for those of you who are in queue and didn't get a chance to ask your question, take your question to your healthcare team and ask them your question over and over again. Also, I just want to remind everybody that we've noticed that during the day, it's really very possible to reach a healthcare provider, but evenings, weekends, and holidays are really hard. And so always check with your healthcare team what number you should call evenings, weekends, and holidays. And with that being said, I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.